In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Yeah.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Time to talk movies. Alan Adams from The Main Edge joining us right here in studio. Hello, sir.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. You were just chatting during the break. You got up, played a little disc golf over the weekend.
We did. Not as much as we intended to, but... the folks at DR in Orrington, they do something they call the super course, which is basically they combine a number of holes from both of their courses and basically extend the length of the course significantly. It was a triples tournament, and so I went out with a couple of buddies of mine. We made it through the first round, and then a couple of us were dragging, and it was like, you know what? We may have overestimated our abilities. We do not have the capacity for this, and so we walked away. That being said, it was a wonderful event. Like, the Edmonds do a great job with all that stuff, and I look forward to going back for a tournament that I may be a little more physically prepared for. So fingers crossed.
Well, yeah, we're all getting back into pre-COVID shape, right?
Oh, sure. Well, is that shape spherical? Because I'm getting there.
I know. I am so jealous of, like, Bruce Pratt, for instance. He lost, like, 20 pounds.
Bruce looks great.
Yeah. And who else told us? Well, Stephen Tobolowsky told us he's lost, like, 20, 25 pounds during the pandemic.
I mean, good for you, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, apparently working out is better than just sitting around steeping in existential dread. Who would have thought?
Yes, yeah. You know, I'm pretty good about getting out and exercising. Unfortunately, it would seem during the pandemic that just gave me more and more justification to then come home and eat.
Well, that's the thing.
A lot.
Like, it's I'm a man of relatively few vices these days, but food and drink, that's pretty much at the top of the list.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh yeah, no, I will eat this delicious food. Oh, what's this? Delectable craft beer made right here in my backyard. Yes, please. Turns out, Rich, I was under the impression that liquid didn't have calories in it.
I know.
And I feel like I've been tricked.
We were sold a bill of goods. Plus, like me, you have a wife who's a very talented cook.
Oh, man. Yeah. Well, it's like, that's one of the things. It's like, I figure me putting on five or 10 pounds over the course of this is the equivalent of a normal person losing 25 because I managed to stave off the, well, I mean, I think ultimately it's inevitable, but so far I've been pretty lucky in that. I think really the thanks go to Stella, because she's the one who ensures that at least twice a day I go out and, you know, move.
Right, let's walk. Let's walk, Dad. Come on. Yes, thank you to Ginger as well. As you probably saw on social media, it's our gotcha day for Ginger 10 years ago today.
Oh, that's so sweet. She's such a good girl.
Nothing better than a rescue dog.
Yeah. We had some good news as well. We took Stella in for her 3-month oncology checkup.
Excellent.
And just clean bill of health.
Oh.
Like, all the scans were clean. Everything was everything's looking good.
Go, Stella.
You know, so it's just like, it continues to be a best case scenario. We just knock on all the wood whenever we can, and it's the one thing that we've noticed is when we first discovered her health concerns, we didn't know what was going to happen, and so we're like, you know what, anything, whatever you want, Stella, anything you want, you can have it. It turns out she learned those lessons very well.
Oh yes.
And
yeah.
So now it's like, well, I mean, I guess she's just gonna jump on people when they come in the house, and I guess she's just gonna get whatever she wants off our plates. And you know what? There are worse ways to live.
There are. Absolutely. Yeah, we've decided that if spoiling the heck out of your dog is wrong, we don't want to be right.
Amen to that, sir. Amen.
Go. Well, let's talk movies. You got a few, and then some big ones to talk about this week. Where do we begin?
Yeah, it's I would say it's probably, this past weekend was probably the sort of the broadest in terms of sort of mainstream releases that we've had. I think since before the theater shut down, just because there's such big ticket sorts of films, and a real sort of runs the gamut kind of situation. You know, you've got your popcorn blockbuster, you've got your movie star gets serious, and then you've got your sort of arty type film. Which one would you like to talk about first?
Oh, I don't know. Let's go with... I'm curious because it didn't do great at the box office. Let's go with Stillwater.
Okay. Yeah. Now, Stillwater is an interesting thing because, you know, the director, Tom McCarthy, probably best known for Spotlight, he wrote and directed this film. And the thing is about making a good movie is it takes a lot of people doing their jobs well. Sometimes a movie can be elevated if one or more of those people involved takes a step forward, like, you know, makes the leap, and their sort of their take can sort of bring everybody else up somewhat. And this is that kind of movie because, like, it's well made. Like, McCarthy's a talented director. You know, the screenplay is pretty good. But I gotta say, Rich, this I don't know when the last time I saw Matt Damon this good. Like, I mean,
that's what everybody's saying.
He's just phenomenal in this movie, and it's one of those movies that I think would have like. It needed that performance. Like, it wasn't like on the other individual pieces were fine, but they weren't enough to elevate this movie. But he is so GD good in this film that it just sort of it's this rising tide that sort of raises all boats. Mm-hmm. You know, he really just brings the entire proceedings up a notch just because of how good he is. The basic story is, Damon plays a guy named Bill Baker. He's a sort of an Oklahoma like oil field roughneck who's sort of in between gigs. You know, very everyman, like lives in Stillwater, Oklahoma. You know, he, you know, gets drive through for dinner every night, you know, and then, you know, and he says grace before he eats it when he's at home. He goes to sleep in front of the television, and, you know, he wakes up and he does it all again, goes back, you know, and. But he's not typical in that every so often, whenever he can, he gets on a plane, flies to Marseille, France, and spends 2 weeks where he's visiting his daughter, a young woman named Allison, played by Abigail Breslin, who is in prison for the murder of her roommate slash lover. And that's it. And so you have this guy who is, you know, very like basically like stereotypically, like archetypally flyover country. Like that's who this guy is. Right. And he is, you know, periodically just dropped into the middle of France. We'll get to it, but there's a lot of, he's very American in a lot of ways. So he's visiting his daughter. She, you know, has this, you know, bit of overheard hearsay that she thinks might help, get her out of prison because she has from the beginning proclaimed her innocence. And her father believes her and is willing to do whatever it takes to help her. And when the system isn't necessarily interested, in this new information that has come to light, Mr. Baker, takes it upon himself to try and make things happen. But he is not necessarily equipped to do that. But he does meet a woman in the hotel one night that is in the room next door, a woman named Virginie, played by, what was her name? Camille Cotton. She's a French actress. I'd never seen her before, but she's very good as well. Who sort of, befriends him, and she and her young daughter Maya sort of befriend this Bill Baker, and she sort of becomes like a go-between almost between, you know, him and France. Like, she basically helps him, guides him, translates for him all this stuff while he's trying to undertake this investigation all on his own. But he has certain failings, and those failings present themselves again and again, interfering with his efforts to help. It's tough. It's tough talking about this movie for a number of reasons. The big one, there's a lot of discourse surrounding Amanda Knox,
right.
McCarthy and Damon both have said on multiple occasions she served as an inspiration for this film. And granted, it's fictionalized and all that. But you know, Amanda Knox has spoken out about sort of, you know, whether it's okay. Like, at what point does her story stop being her own, and you know, other people can use it for these sorts of ends?
Right.
And like, I honestly don't know the answer. I mean, it's a very complicated subject. I think the reality is that your personal story becomes less your own when you become a public figure, whether right. it's by choice or not.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily believe that that's right, but that's the way it is, at least for now. So that's challenging. But ultimately, this movie is good because of Matt Damon. It would be fine. But it's good because of Matt Damon, because it is, it's, I don't know, it's subtle in a way that we haven't seen Matt Damon be subtle in a very long time. Like, it's very low key. Like, he's got this sort of gruff, drawling sort of attitude. A lot of monosyllables, like a lot of yes ma'ams and no sirs. Like, it's very, it very much embodies a certain image of a certain type of person. But you also have these wonderful moments of just these. This was something, and it's such a small thing, but I feel the need to point it out just because it struck me as so wonderful in the moment. There's a spot where he's visiting Virginie, and they're listening to his music, like his iPod, and an old-timey country song comes on. I can't remember what one it was, but he was all of a sudden he lights up, and he's like, "Oh yeah, this is a great song." And, you know, and she's like, "What's so great?" And he's like, "Well, you can dance to it." And so the two of them, he invites her over, and they start to slow dance in the middle of this kitchen. And you'll know it. You'll know what I'm describing. There's a certain type of man. When they slow dance, they look off to the side towards the floor, and you can, they're not, their lips aren't moving, but you can hear them counting the steps.
Yes.
And it's there, like, wow. it's just like little moments like that where you're like, "Oh, okay, yeah, Matt Damon came to play." And the movie is filled with stuff like that. Like, Breslin's good, Camille Cotton's very good, the supporting cast is great, but it's Matt Damon's movie, and for good reason, because it is legitimately one of the best performances we've seen from him in, I don't know, a decade, maybe more.
Now, why do you think the numbers weren't great? Is it because, you know, people want to see lighthearted summer fare, or is it because the people that might be the audience for this movie in particular aren't going back to the theaters yet?
I think it's a combination of those things, honestly. I think there's probably some disconnect with regard to maybe the people that Damon is representing in this movie. Maybe they're afraid that he's, you know, making fun, or mm-hmm. you know, if it's some sort of somehow condemning, which it very much is not. It is right. a very sympathetic portrayal. But yeah, I mean, I think ultimately it suffers from the fact that one big Disney extravaganza opened this weekend, and you know, there's another one still in theaters, plus that the Fast and Furious movie is still kicking around,
right?
Like, it's just, I think it's one of those things where, especially right now, for movies like this, I think people are going to wait. I think it's not necessarily a movie that needs to be seen on the big screen, and particularly when you're talking about a story that has a basis in a story that we all kind of already know,
right?
I think the urgency isn't there. Okay. So
is it going to streaming anytime soon?
I'm guessing a lot of these, it depends on this, and I don't know the studio off the top of my head. A lot of the studios have greatly truncated the sort of window between theatrical release and streaming. Right. One would hope that, especially with a movie like this, after seeing the frankly dismal box office numbers, they would want to pick up the pace and just get that movie in front of some eyeballs.
Right. Absolutely. Alan Adams with us on Downtown. Let's talk about that big Disney blockbuster. How was Jungle Cruise?
It's all right. It's fine. Look, man, I don't know anyone who was clamoring for another Disney theme park ride to be turned into a movie. But apparently they're out there. I get it. Like, it's one of those things where it's from a financial standpoint, like, it's the sort of thing that almost guarantees a certain level of box office, and then you stick the Rock in it and you've got that going for you. You know, so I mean, it's just gonna, you know, the cash is gonna roll in. It's a movie that for whatever else it brings to the table, it's gonna make a lot of money. And you know, from a creative artistic standpoint, it's gonna make a lot of money. Like that's what this movie is about. And look, it's a very familiar kind of movie. Like it's action adventure, family oriented. It does. I mean, it is a PG-13. So, and there are some stretches where, like the younger kids, it might be a little intense for them. But for the most part, if you've got someone, you know, 10, 9, 10, 11 in your household, like they're gonna have a perfectly good time watching this movie. You might struggle with boredom in some stretches, but the kids will dig it. Like, it's a movie that. You know, it rides pretty hard on the chemistry between the two leads. You've got The Rock and you've got Emily Blunt, and you know, and their dynamics and the other performances in the film are very good. It doesn't quite make up for the pretty thin plot and the ubiquity of CGI. Like, there's just a lot of computer generated nonsense in this movie. A lot of it, and a lot of it feels unnecessary. And so that's kind of a distraction. So the basic gist is we're in 1916 during during World War I. We've got a botanist named Lily Houghton. That's Emily Blunt, who's trying to locate this legendary plant in the Amazon. It's called the Tears of the Moon, and its petals are purported to have these amazing like powers. A lot of people have been lost in search of Tears of the Moon, including an expedition by conquistadors that we get to see. A group of conquistadors led by Don Aguirre, played by Edgar Ramirez, who comes to an unfortunate end if the legends are to be believed. So Dr. Houghton finds an artifact that she thinks is the key to locating the Tears of the Moon. She steals it right out from under the nose of a Prince Joachim, played by the can't believe he's here, but I'm happy to see him, Jesse Plemons.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in full-on German accent. He's the third son of the Kaiser. and really camping it up in a fabulous way. She grabs her brother, McGregor, played by Jack Whitehall, who's also excellent, and they head to South America, to Brazil, and they try to charter a boat to take them up the Amazon so they can find the Tears of the Moon. And wouldn't you know, the boat they charter is skippered by one Frank Wolf, The Rock, in full-on, I'm the Rock mode. Like, I mean, it's not like he's not playing a part. Like, he's just being The Rock.
Being The Rock.
And, you know, and more power to him. Like, I love it. I love watching him be The Rock. So, and I'm far from alone in that. So she enlists him to take her upriver to try and find the Tears of the Moon. But as it turns out, there are a lot of obstacles in the way, Rich. Enemies, both natural and supernatural, who are pursuing them and trying to keep them from their goal. Everyone wants the Tears of the Moon for their own reason, and it's up to The Rock and Emily Blunt to save the day and what have you. Like, look, it's goofy and it's fun. Like, The Rock and Emily Blunt are wonderful together. Like, they have a great chemistry. The dynamics between them is... there's a very screwball comedy kind of vibe to them. Like, I mean, it's the homages to classic films are pretty, you know, a little on the nose at times. Like, The Rock is straight up dressed like Humphrey Bogart from The African Queen at one point. Like, it's just like there's just a lot of stuff like that. But the performances are really good. Like, the Rock is, again, he's The Rock, but nobody's better at being The Rock than The Rock.
No.
Emily Blunt is a delight. Jack Whitehall is really, really fun. Edgar Ramirez, who plays Aguirre, he's great. Plemons, again, is going for it in just the most delightful way. Just thick German accent, like lunatic in a submarine in the Amazon, just so good. We get a couple of scenes with another one who's really camping it up. Paul Giamatti's in this movie.
Oh, man.
As sort of the guy who runs the river trade in this little town that The Rock is operating out of. But, like, big weird Italian accent. He's got like a gold tooth, like just ridiculous, but in a fun way. And that's basically what you could boil this movie down to, that ridiculous, but in a fun way.
There you go. All right. Finally, the third of this week's new films. Let's talk about Dev Patel in The Green Knight.
I'll start with just a quick story about actually seeing this movie, because I didn't know a ton about it going in. I know David Lowery wrote and directed. I know Dev Patel starred, and I had vague recollections of the sort of medieval poem on which the movie is based from reading it back in high school. But that was pretty much it. That was all I had. It was not at all what I was anticipating. More to the point, it was not at all what many of the other people in the audience were anticipating. Mm. I saw people leave. Like, people people left the movie.
Wow.
Not to put too fine a point on it, I vehemently disagree with the choices made by those people. Because this is a spectacular movie. It is not at all what you would expect to find in a movie theater at the end of July. That's for certain. It is quite possibly the weirdest, like, mainstream movie that I have seen. The one that immediately leapt to mind for me, and they're completely different movies in most ways, but the one that leapt to mind for me was from back in 2017, Darren Aronofsky's Mother. Like, it was like weird, oh, yeah. like just wow. Like one of those things where it's like, oh, this is not at all what anyone expected. But this movie, it's beautiful. Like, it's aesthetically, it's just an absolute visual feast. You know, beautiful shot after beautiful shot, like a wonderful utilization of color, you know, saturated and muted, and just like, and you know, completely, you know, embracing the opportunities presented by the various landscapes in which the film was made, and featuring a performance by a guy who I think we have to start talking about him in the top tier, Dev Patel, as far as talent with as movie actors go, because he is excellent and he is consistently excellent and he is as good as he's ever been in this movie. It's based on the sort of 14th century chivalric romance, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And Sir Gawain is how it's pronounced. I've only read it before, so I always thought it was Gawain.
Mm.
But everyone in this film pronounces it Gawain, so I'm going with them.
All
right. So he's the nephew of the king. It's Christmas Day. He wakes up in a brothel with his preferred lover, a woman named Essel, played by the always wonderful Alicia Vikander. Rushes home, changes his clothes, gets a rebuke from his mother, played by Sarita Chudery, and then heads to court. There's a holiday feast, sitting alongside all the realm's many knights. The king, played by Sean Harris, who's wonderful, invites his nephew to sit with him, and they talk about a little bit about the realities of, you know, being part of the royal line and whatever. And then suddenly, the titular Green Knight appears, bursting this sort of tree-like creature that stands 7 feet tall and has this imposing voice and a giant axe, and comes in and basically is like, I have a game for you. Whoever dares to fight me, wherever you strike me, I will return that strike in 1 year's time, or something along those lines. Everyone's kind of leery about engaging with the magic tree knight, as you might think. But Gawain stands up and he's like, I'll do it. He goes in to face the knight. The knight drops his axe and bends his head and basically is like, do what you will. In a panic, kind of nervous and confused, Gawain just just slices off the head of the Green Knight.
Oh dear.
No spoilers. It happens in like the first, I don't know, 10 minutes of the movie, so we're good. Basically is like, yeah, so there we go. And then the knight's decapitated body stands up, picks up the head, which talks to him and reminds Gawain of the terms of the game, and then rides off laughing. 1 year later, well, it's time to go to the Green Chapel and fulfill the other end of the game. And so the film is largely the sort of journey from the castle to the Green Chapel, where he will finally fulfill his destiny as finishing the game that has been initiated by the Green Knight. And through it all, we get to see him, he encounters, brigands and ghosts and, animal guides and magical giants. And just it's this weird and wild sort of almost phantasmagoric kind of combination of different things, like, and it's structured in such a way that so much of the film plays out like without dialogue. Like it's so much of it is just Dev Patel on screen by himself, as he makes his way, along this quest that he doesn't want to go on. Like he's afraid. Like he fears what's going to happen to him when he arrives at his destination. But so many around him have sort of almost shamed him into having to fulfill the bargain that he struck. So despite his fear and his doubt, he lets that push him forward. It's not, what you have is this story that is, it's about the difference between responsibility and obligation, the difference between courage and fear, and this wonderfully complex and nuanced sort of story, all of it playing out against a backdrop, again, like just absolutely stunning to look at, just screen picture after screen picture of just these memorable images, wide shots where we see how dwarfed he is by the landscape that surrounds him. And then these tight shots where we can really see the sort of fear and doubt sort of building behind his eyes. And in the midst of all that, he's, dealing with all assorted weirdnesses, whether it's, the decapitated ghost that he finds in a mysterious cabin, or the manor house in the middle of nowhere where he meets a lord and lady, the lord, by the way, played by Joel Edgerton, who's also excellent, and just this wonderfully complicated story playing out in such a way, like almost entirely through pictures. Like it's not like they're not using dialogue to tell us the story. We're seeing the story. The story is playing out through these various images, and it's so beautiful and so striking, and it has one of the more memorable ending sequences of a movie that I've encountered. I'm not going to spoil that because, it came as quite a little shock to me when it hit. So it was just like, oh, okay. Like this is different than what I thought I was watching, but it's better now. Like it's that kind of movie. Again, this is a super challenging movie. Like I saw a headline, for another review that basically said, The Green Knight is great art, but not great entertainment. And I don't know if I fully agree with that, but I understand the gist of the sentiment. Like it is very much an artistic achievement, it's not going to be for everybody. Right. Like if you prefer traditionally narrative driven film, like this probably isn't going to work for you. Like this is very much an allegory, and in much the same way that Mother was. Like I think that's the sort of crossover in the Venn diagram between those two movies, that idea of using film as a way to express these sort of allegorical intentions. But David Lowery, it's a wonderful, wonderful movie. It makes you work. Like it's not gonna you're not gonna sit back there and watch The Rock wrestle a CGI jaguar. Like it's not that kind of movie. But if you don't mind being challenged, and you and if you have an appreciation for the value of aesthetics when it comes to film, like I gotta tell you, like you really need to check out The Green Knight. It's good stuff.
Awesome. Hey, thanks, Al.
Hey, my pleasure.
Appreciate it. We'll see you Wednesday.
Yeah, you will.